Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. It's October 30th, 2019. I am Fran Sorcendi, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can call us at 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Guess what today is?
Hey, it's the day before Halloween.
Right.
Right.
So if it's the day before, well, you said it was the day before Halloween, or what's today's date?
It's the 30th.
Right. If that's all you said, there's a few things I know about you. First of all, you're not from Detroit, because tonight in Detroit is Devil's Night.
Okay, no, I am not from Detroit, and I certainly didn't know that.
And you're also not from Cincinnati.
That's true also. What's Cincinnati?
Cabbage
night, of course, because, you know, that's when you go out and you carve your cabbage, and you put a little light in the inside of it.
Is that right?
I have no idea.
I have no idea either. I also happen to know that you're not from the urban areas of New Jersey, and also apparently East Windsor and Hightstown, where I grew up, where it's known as Mischief Night.
Okay.
See, I always knew the day before Halloween as Mischief Night, and then I only found out, like, this year that it's not Mischief Night everywhere. I thought that October 30th was always Mischief Night. So it's the night that you go out. Don't necessarily do this, okay? But you egg the car and you toilet paper the trees.
No, you do that on Halloween.
Right, exactly.
Right. It's trick or treat, and if you don't treat us, then
we're going to play a trick. No.
We're going to play a trick
on
you.
In Jersey, it's a two-day affair.
That's why they call it trick or treat.
Two-day affair in New Jersey.
That's my thing.
It's Mischief Night. Mischief Night, and that's what's done. So why is there a Mischief Night? Do you know? One function is maybe because there's people who have theories about why Mischief Night is the way it is. One is that it's simply, it's fun. A cigar is a cigar. And it's fun to go out at night with our friends and do minor mischief. But also, it teaches you stuff. It's not the education that you learn in a classroom, but what you learn informally when you're among the members of a distinct folk group. If you're fortunate, you might learn something on Mischief Night about yourselves as you transition from childhood to adulthood. So there's a story or a film in that. The other function is that there's validation and reinforcement of beliefs and conduct because, you know, it's a tradition. Anyway,
okay.
So you're sharing in the activities of Mischief Night. You maintain the tradition of the folk group, which are passed on from one cohort to the next, apparently in New Jersey.
Apparently.
And there's another function of Mischief Night, which is to provide socially sanctioned and approved outlets for expressing minor aggressions, tensions, cultural taboos, and fantasies. You know that movie, The Purge? That's much, much worse. Much worse. I mean, The Purge was about you have a free night to kill anyone you want, which is just terrible.
There's something pretty wrong about that.
Yeah. But this is... I guess if you get caught, you could get in trouble if you get caught egging a car or putting toilet paper on a tree. But, you know, it's eggs, it's toilet paper. What are you going to do? Seems like a waste of a perfectly good protein source to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So when you do Mischief Night, that, you know, people use the night to test the boundaries of what they might, like, you know, they dare people to do stuff, and so you learn stuff about yourself when you get to do that. So it adds up to a folklore tradition, and folklore does things to maintain stability, solidarity, cohesiveness, and continuity of groups. So traditions are a good thing. This is a mischievous tradition, but, you know, there are other traditions that are good. So any group, whether it's based on an occupation, religion, region, or ethnicity, or gender, they want to preserve a group identity. And so when you observe Mischief Night, it's one thing, one fun way to do it. Anyway, whether you celebrate Mischief Night tonight or you do your mischief on Halloween, have fun. Don't hurt anybody. Don't get hurt yourself. Don't eat too much candy. But, you know, if you want to, eat some. And one of the things I did is I ordered a book recently on low and no sugar sweets, like, you know, sort of keto friendly desserts. So I'm looking forward to receiving that book and making some recipes, and I'll report on some of the recipes once I start getting into it. And also big shout out to Emily Puckett, who at Puckett's Pantry, who makes, I've been enjoying her keto desserts. So that's, you know, that's one place you can get those things, and you can also make them yourself. I mean, if there's ways to make desserts where they have a little less sugar and a little less carbs and have more healthy ingredients in them. So anyway, you know, that Emily is one person who's out there fighting the good fight. Very good.
Okay.
So anyway, so we found, so here I've got a mix and match of topics here tonight. One of the things that I wanted to talk about is there's another scientific reason why you gain weight in middle age without changing anything. The first reason that I understood, it's because you have reduced estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone, which are your reproductive hormones, and they tend to go down, you know, when you get into middle age and beyond, and they push hormone-sensitive lipase, which helps you to burn fat. But there's a reason beyond that, that's not just that. And I love this article in Bicycling Magazine. The midlife weight gain struggle is real. The struggle is real. And there are things you can do about it. So it's an undeniable phenomenon. So what happens is that this is another study. There's a switch that turns on in your fat cells as you get older, making it easier to gain weight, even if you don't eat more or exercise less than before. So there was a study that was done at Uppsala University in Sweden and also the University of Lyon in France that found that lipid turnover, the capacity to store and remove lipids, that means the fats in your fat cells, changes for the worse at age. Our lipid removal rates decrease while our storage rate remains the same. So your ability to put it on stays the same, but your ability to get rid of it you get less efficient at getting rid of fat. That's what they found. So this is different. So this is about a storage and release rate, and this is a different mechanism than simply your hormones go down and you don't push your hormone-sensitive lipase. So that's my understanding. And when they studied this, they saw a decrease in lipid turnover among men and women. Participants who didn't reduce their calorie intake during the period saw a substantial weight gain, increasing their body. So a substantial weight gain that if you eat the same, now mind you, this is an average because this doesn't happen to everybody. It all depends on your metabolism. So, but for the average person, and overall, on the overall average, if you don't reduce your caloric intake as you get older, you're going to gain 20% of your body weight. So that means if you weigh 150 pounds, you're going to weigh 180 pounds. That's pretty scary. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So again, if you're starting out at a high rate of fat turnover, it's going to depend on how much your fat turnover goes down. So you can't stop that process. You can bump up your daily fat burn. So, and all exercise helps, of course, but guess what helps? Guess what exercise helps the most? I'll give you a guess. The last three don't count.
Walking.
Oh God. No.
Bicycling.
Not, why does everybody say walking and bicycling?
Because.
No, that's
oh,
not
the one that you'll do.
It's not that either.
That too. But
no,
anyway.
It's not that.
Okay.
This has to do with
where
the science of how you exercise. No, it's a type of exercise, not a specific exercise.
Oh, cardiovascular exercise.
Oh, God. Forget it. It's high-intensity interval training.
Oh, high-intensity interval training.
Right.
Well,
so that means that high-intensity interval training, that's going to be whether you do resistance training or you do it on a bicycle or and. They studied postmenopausal women who did 20-minute cycling sessions that had high-intensity interval training and stationary bikes three times a week for 12 weeks. They improved their fat burning and decreased levels of abdominal fat better than their peers who did 40 minutes of moderate cycling.
Hmm.
So the people who cycled longer and but didn't do intervals didn't lose as much fat as the people who did the intervals. So, So I think that, you know, when I climb hills, I have an advantage because that's definitely interval training. If you, you know, if you do hill climbing and if you do interval workouts, and certainly when we go in the spin room, that's all we do. We do interval workouts.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's basically what we do. So that's a big help. And if you add resistance training, when you do resistance training and interval training, there you get a bigger weight loss. So you basically have to, when you get older, you have to eat less, but you can mitigate this. The big thing to do is interval training and do resistance training. So I'm thinking that, you know, once I'm completely indoors this winter, maybe I'll add a little more weight training. I mean, I'm doing a half an hour of weight training twice a week, but maybe I'll mix it up a little bit and do a little more, like add another weight training session per week. Or, I mean, what I usually do is I go to yoga, but I don't always make it to yoga. But, you know, I don't know if I want to count the yoga. I might want to do an extra weight training session. I know, right?
It's yeah. So, like, you know.
I know, but what I probably should do is take a class. If I take a class, then I don't have to think about it. It's easier.
Yeah.
Like, I'll do my two sessions at home, but I'll do one session where I just take a class, and that would be a good thing to do. I'll see about that. But that was an interesting thing. It has to do with fat turnover. This is the turnover of fat in your cells. And what I need to do is look at the actual article to get the mechanism, because it's not, I don't think it's the same as the reduction in hormones, that you no longer have the hormone sensitive lipase as active. So it's a couple of things, and so this happens in men and women. So as we're moving indoors, think about indoor interval training. Like, if you just hang up your bike in the winter and you don't do very much,
that's not smart.
And you're older, you're going to gain weight. I like to mix it up. I kind of enjoy the point where I'm like, all right, now I'm into my indoor interval training, because I know what I'm supposed to do and I'm going to go ahead and do it. And, it's different than what I do during the year. So it's a change. And I feel like that change is good. It would be weird if I lived in Florida and I could just ride all year. I mean, looking at my friends in Florida, because, you know, I'm connected with them on Facebook, and, you know, my members of the Gulf Coast Fellow, they ride all year. They're good. They're about to do the horrible 100.
Ew.
Yeah. Well, listen to this. This is really funny. The horrible 100 is a really hilly ride.
How could it possibly be hilly if it's in Florida?
Well,
is
listen,
it up in the panhandle?
It's 100. It's 100 miles. It's a century ride. It's 2,500 feet of climbing.
Sorry.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
You
got foofed.
Go to New Jersey.
You got foofed.
I used to go to New Jersey to do the Princeton Freewheelers event because it was a flat century. Mm-hmm. And it was 2,400 feet.
Right.
That's pretty funny.
I know.
I listened to that. And they call it the horrible 100. And my friend Wendy, she said, it's also pretty hot when you do it.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, it's November.
Right, it's November 16th. Well,
it's
still...
Right. It's hot, but it's not like it was in the summertime.
Probably not, but it's not... You're right, but it's still going to be pretty warm.
That's the time that you can get all the discount hotels and things down in Florida this
November?
Time. No, between now and Christmas, yeah.
I see.
It's like their least popular time in Florida.
Oh, all right.
Because the weather is getting cold.
Right.
And the it's before the holidays, so everybody just doesn't go.
Right. No, people don't go until the holidays or beyond.
But
right.
I've been down there then, and it's like, it's, you know, you're happy to see a day that gets up into the mid-upper 60s.
In November?
Yeah.
No, wrong. I don't believe that.
Anyway.
Yeah.
We'll
have to take a look. I mean, mm-hmm. I can have a look at what the, it's almost November now. Let's see what the weather's looking like for Venice, Florida now. I'm not buying it. Yeah. Because, all right.
No, you're not.
I'm not, and also I want to know what the
So, you know, I mean, it could be, whatever. It could be.
It's right now it's 83 degrees in Venice. So
okay, but that's still not that hot.
Feels like 91.
Okay, that's hot.
Relative to now, I mean, because it's very humid there right now. That's why.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
So that's this weekend.
Yeah, it's November 16th. Yeah, okay. November. No, it's not this weekend. It's in a couple weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. So, right. So it might, the temperature might have gone down. It's true. When we were there last year, we were there at right after Christmas, and we're going again. And it was in the 70s, and we were lucky. And 2 years ago, it did get down into the 40s. We'll see what happens this year. All right. So that was good. So I wanted to check in with you. How are you?
I'm good.
You are?
I'm better. Yeah. I would say much better.
Have you gotten on your bike yet?
I have sat on a bicycle seat.
Right.
I have not actually ridden a bike. I mean, I sat on a bicycle seat in spin class.
And you did not pedal.
But I very, very easy, no resistance on the pedals at all.
Did you do this while you were teaching or did you do it? Okay.
Yeah.
Did everybody get excited?
Well, they're excited. They said, so Friday, right?
Yeah.
You know, because I've been given the go-ahead on November 1st.
Right. And that's
as far
Friday.
As that goes, which is, you know, I'm still not fully recovered and I need to certainly be paying attention to not going too hard.
Right.
But November 1st has been the, okay, you can get back on your bicycle day.
Yeah.
You know,
you
I say that.
Just be really
with,
careful.
I am going to be like super careful. I have, because I still can feel things like inside. I can still feel things that because I was, you know, I was sewn up inside.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm definitely still experiencing that, especially over here on the right side.
Yeah.
So there's something here. If I push down hard, I can feel it.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, I still have stitches, which you can see where they were. I mean, I think they probably all dissolved at this point.
Right. You had dissolving sutures.
Right. And I have a surgeon's appointment tomorrow in the morning. So we'll talk about it, I'm sure.
Good.
And see where I'm at as far as that goes. But I've also been walking a lot because I'm bored out of my mind. And, you know, I need to do something. And I have another friend who is out of work right now, and so he and I are going out for walks.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
Which is great, and we'll do another one this week, too.
Oh, you will?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so that's, if not a, a rail trail ride, maybe on Friday or something, but we'll see. We'll see. I have to kind of play everything by ear. I have a funny feeling I'm not going to be quite up for that, but if I do anything at all, it will be very flat, very easy.
You need to have a test run. I don't know if it's a good idea to plan a ride
as your first thing.
You need a test run.
I think that spin class is probably going to be enough.
Oh, yeah. I don't even know.
Because I can regulate that
also. I don't
even
know if you want to do that. I mean, because really you want to get on the bike and you want to do a test run. And I don't know if you want to do it. Because the problem is when you're in spin class, you're going to get excited and you're going to want to do what they're doing and you could hurt yourself.
I won't do that.
I have had athletic patients in the past have abdominal surgery and they're athletes. So they get back to it too soon and they come to me a bunch of times complaining that they're sore and they don't feel good and their abdomen is sore. I'm like, well, you got back to it too soon. So you really, that's really a thing.
Yeah. I understand.
You have to be careful.
I'm gonna be careful.
Obviously the walking is working well, and that's great.
Walking has been wonderful.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a nice thing. So are you able to eat normally now?
I am eating normally. There's
great.
Nothing that I am not eating
okay.
at this point that
that's
I wasn't
terrific.
Eating before this
and,
happened.
And your digestion's
so
all right?
Digestion is A-okay. It's
terrific.
Actually as good as it was, if not. You know, well, I can't say better, but definitely as good as it was.
That's great.
Without any major consequences or problems.
And so, what are you still taking supplement-wise?
Still taking the GI repair. I'm still taking those little, I don't know what they are, the ones that, the homeopathy.
You're taking, you're alternating arnica and hypericum.
Yep,
yes.
There you go. You know before I do.
Mm-hmm.
What else am I taking? There's other things that I'm doing.
You're taking that fermented ginger?
Yeah.
So you're taking fermented ginger capsules? That's great.
I'm doing that. And I'm also probiotics and
very good.
Kefir.
Yes.
Still doing that
good.
And trying to stay on top of that because
good.
I'm very concerned about my immune system and
yeah.
possibly that being the problem. Although the more I'm starting to think about this, you know, that whole episode that I had could have been, like you said, coming on. And the blockage that I had
yeah.
could have been the source of the reason why I couldn't keep any food down. And
yeah.
it may have just happened.
Right. You mean that you didn't have an acute gastroenteritis in the beginning, that it was
yeah.
just that
I'm starting to think that maybe it was, you know.
Well, didn't you have chills and fever the first day?
Chills and fever.
You were wearing, you were sitting and you were sweating and you were wearing a sweatshirt and.
Yeah, I guess I did. Yeah.
Right.
So I might have had that too. Well, anyway, who knows? Whatever. I ended up with, you know, obviously.
Well, we can't know for sure
issue.
because I didn't catch it. And one of the reasons I may not have caught it was because I took things to prevent me getting it, but
right.
also I came home and scoured the house with bleach. So, but we don't know for sure if it was a.
But I haven't heard anything back from anybody else from, you know, the crew at the Farm to Fork
that
of
they also got sick.
Complaining about it. So I think it was just, I don't know what it was. Whatever it was, it definitely led to I would say, a very large can of worms.
Yeah.
That got pretty messy at the end.
Right.
But.
All right.
And
not as messy as it could have gotten.
And not as messy as it could have gotten. So
right.
I attended to it in time, which was good.
Right.
So, and, you know, I'm healing. I'm healing slowly, but I am walking a lot.
Yeah, that's
so
good.
I'm not just walking the 2 miles a day I was walking in the hospital.
Right.
Which kind of flipped them all out. But
right.
I'm, you know, up to 4 to 6 miles a day.
Yeah,
so.
That's good.
So it's not bad. It's not bad. Yeah. And I'm doing some light yard work and, you know, I'm just being cautious.
I think you need to do a little more light yard work because I think those chairs are going to need to come in this weekend.
Yeah, everything needs to come in. There's
yeah.
all sorts of stuff that needs to happen
because
it's fall
list.
And these things are like things
yeah.
that you have to do before.
And
you
got
to button up before winter. You
I
know?
Don't want those chairs to sit outside all winter.
No.
Especially not the new Adirondack chairs we got.
No. Yeah. They're all going to get, everything's going to get buttoned up.
Yes.
So we're
That's
taking
good.
Care of it. That's what you do as a New Englander. You button up before winter.
Button up.
Yeah.
So
and
you can
I
button
still,
up so you can hunker down.
Right. You got it. You
yeah.
got it. So.
All right. So speaking of gastrointestinal stuff, there's an antibiotic-resistant E. coli strain around.
Okay.
Yay.
Yay. That's what
so,
we like to hear.
Right. So if you, unfortunately, you don't know where it could be. It could be at the restaurant. Somebody at the restaurant could have it or, you know, it could be anywhere. So washing your hands a lot is a really good idea. Is generally a good idea. So washing your hands is really the best way to not have it. So if you're in a bathroom, it's really important to wash your hands with whatever soap they have and scrub. You need to spend your time scrubbing. Again, you can't see me through the microphone, but you want to spend your time scrubbing and give it a good scrub with whatever soap they have and spend 25 seconds doing it. If you have to slowly sing the ABCs or the Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, that's fine. Or Happy Birthday. And when you wash your hands and scrub, you're scrubbing the bacteria off of your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just inviting them off. And the soap, to some extent, will kill bacteria, but the scrubbing is the biggest thing. So the E. coli have an extended spectrum beta-lactamase. And so because penicillins and cephalosporins are they're beta-lactamase antibiotics, this strain of E. coli can destroy them. So if you take penicillin or cephalosporins, these bacteria can kill those antibiotics. So if you scrub them off, and also if you take probiotics, especially if you you can take probiotic pills or you can consume kefir. So kefir is one of my favorite things to recommend because it has really long-standing, sustainable probiotics in it. And if you consume kefir, you'll find that kefir is a little more sour than yogurt. And that's because it has more probiotics in it that are doing more fermentation. So you're going to taste more of the sour compounds, the glucuronic acid and the acetic acid and the different and the lactic acid and the different things that the yogurt that the bacteria make. And, you know, they make vitamins for you and they kill bad guys. And they set up an acidic environment that's not friendly to pathogenic bacteria and other pathogenic microorganisms. So kefir is a really good way to go. Now, if you're dairy intolerant, if you're lactose intolerant, you're probably going to be able to consume kefir because kefir doesn't have a lot of lactose in it, doesn't have a lot of the milk sugar that if you can't break it down, it gives you gas. But if you have a dairy protein intolerance, you will not do well with kefir made from dairy. You might, if you do better with goat dairy, you can get goat kefir from, made from goat's milk, which is also really good for you. And if you can't do any dairy at all, that's just fine. You can get water kefir. There are products that you can just buy in the store that are water kefir. They have the probiotics that are in kefir, but they're made from a coconut base. And you can also make it at home and using a coconut base. So that if you want to do that.
It's really good. I like it a lot.
Kefir.
Yeah, I like it. It works. It works for me.
Yeah. So here's an interesting one. I heard that the Always brand of the Always brand of sanitary products is taking the female symbol off their packaging. And there's a reason why. It's to be sensitive to...
Is it political correctness?
Oh, stop.
I know.
So this opens a can of worms. Mm-hmm. So what they're doing is they're taking the female symbol off of their packaging. It's out of respect for transgender and non-binary people because there are trans men and non-binary people who don't identify specifically female who menstruate. So there are people who identify as men who menstruate. If you have a female symbol on the packaging,
right,
it's telling you that this is for women. So that term politically correct has become a fraught term because there are people who are like, oh, I'm so tired of being politically correct. Oh. And, there's people on both sides of the spectrum. Now I have to think about this. Well, you know, maybe you do have to think about this. And here's why. The people who are asking for respect have really been slammed for many, many years, slammed and hurt and even beaten and violated for many, many years. So people who have, who are transgender and who are non-binary have had to suffer because of who they are. And, you know, you and I don't know what it's like to be trans or non-binary, but other people are trans and non-binary. They're not hurting anybody or anything. That's who they are. That's how they experience themselves. Why is this even a problem? And the problem is not, I don't think the problem is so much with them. The problem is with other people, is people not accepting who they are. There have been people who experience themselves as trans or who gender bend or who are non-binary throughout history. There were shamans in tribal cultures who were revered because they expressed themselves as both masculine and feminine. There were, all throughout history, there have been people like that. It's not just now that they're coming out. They've always been there. It's just that we're having a moment where they're being recognized in a big way. And I think that's a good thing, that if people want to express themselves along a spectrum of gender, who's it hurting?
Doesn't hurt anyone.
No, doesn't hurt anyone. So this is the thing about political correctness. When a group identifies itself and says, you know, I'm experiencing pain, I'm experiencing hurt, I'm being bullied. There's so many groups like that. Society can be really cruel about, recognizing people who are different from the norm. And have you ever, I love this. So Anna McIntosh, may she rest in peace. She was my teacher in naturopathic college. She said, have you ever met a normal person? I haven't. It's one of her best lines.
What's normal?
Why be normal? Yeah, what is normal? Normal is an average, but an average is made up of all kinds of points along the spectrum in order to come to that average. So everybody is an individual. So I'm annoyed that political correctness has become a negative word. You know, that there's a negative connotation to mm-hmm. that. It's just an umbrella term that helps us to identify issues that we need to be more sensitive to. And maybe we weren't sensitive to them ongoing through history. So, you know, we weren't sensitive to race. We weren't sensitive to religion. We weren't sensitive to culture. We weren't sensitive to how people dress. We're still not sensitive. And we're still not sensitive to a lot of these things. Oh, my goodness. Size discrimination. How about you? You've had trouble getting a job because of your age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people discriminate for all sorts of reasons that are not fair and that have nothing to do with who the person actually is.
Or what they're capable of.
Mm-hmm. And why can't gender be celebrated like anything else, like any other qualities of a person, where a person comes from, why can't we celebrate people who are black and brown and white and red and yellow and all of those other, all the iterations of humans? Why can't we celebrate everyone who they are? And we have a problem in that we don't, and that we discriminate. And, you know, I could go into great depth about how there's still institutionalized racism in this country. I have to think about my nephews. The thing, you realize that parents of black and brown and other colored children, those parents have to have discussions with those children about how to behave around law enforcement. My nephews, my flesh and blood, my sister's going to have that conversation with my nephews.
Sure she is.
And, you know, I have to be nervous now that Harry's, taller than me and almost 200 pounds. Harry is now at risk for being targeted. And he's one of the nicest boys you ever want to meet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my nephews are the most handsome, nicest, smartest and most athletic
and
terrific.
No bias here at all. None whatsoever.
Yes, Harry, Tally, and Marley. They're the best nephews ever at all.
Okay.
And that's a completely objective opinion.
Right.
And but they are my nephews of color, and Nancy's gonna have to have that talk with them. It's terrifying. So when you talk about politically correct, if politically correct means that a law enforcement person doesn't look at a person of color with any more bias than anyone else, and those people of color are just as likely to be put in jail as anybody else who was a different color or white, then that political correctness is a useful thing. It's just an umbrella term that helps us to be more sensitive to groups who have been marginalized and even violated and abused. So, you know what? If they're taking the feminine symbol off of always pads, more power to them. Because, you know, I had a good friend when I was going through naturopathic college who was a trans man. And he used to get his period. And it freaked him out. Because, you know, he hadn't had that level of surgery at that time.
Mm.
So he used to menstruate. And it used to upset him so much and made him dysphoric. And, you know, the level when, you know, you're not supported in the culture and you have gender dysphoria because you have not transitioned or you've transitioned and you're having difficulty with it. It's a very, very profound, deep depression. And you need to be sensitive of that. And if you have to, you know, you're menstruating, you don't even want to be menstruating in the first place. And then you have to look at the package and there's a female symbol on it. It's like, okay, this is not for me. I have to use it, but it's not for me. It's recognizing people who identify as purely female. So you feel excluded. So, you know, more power to always for recognizing this and helping trans and non-binary people to feel more included. I think it's cool. I'm up for it.
It is cool.
Okay.
All right.
Good. All right. So here's another interesting thing I found. If you're on blood pressure medication, so if you have a blood pressure problem, it might be a good idea to take your blood pressure meds at night instead of in the morning. You know, a lot of people, you know, part of their morning routine, going to take their meds, makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there was a study that showed that there was a risk reduction of death from heart and blood vessel problems if you take your blood pressure meds at night. There was, and it was significant. There was a 66% drop in problems with heart, your heart and blood vessels, a 49% decrease in stroke risk, and a 44% decrease in heart attack, myocardial infarction risk, and a 49% decrease in heart failure risk. So it could be an issue if one of your meds is a diuretic, because diuretics make you go to the bathroom. So you have to get up during the night and go to the bathroom. I find that if I'm not sleeping really deeply, which I do sometimes because, you know, stress and menopause and not enough estrogen and like that, I find that I get up anyway. Or if I eat something salty for supper, then I'll wake up and have to drink. So it's so if you're taking blood pressure medications, you can consider taking your blood pressure medication at night. Now, if your blood pressure medication is working the way you want it to and you're taking it in the morning, then by all means, keep doing that. But if you want to get an edge, you might try taking it at night. We also talk about taking thyroid meds at night as well.
Mm-hmm.
The thyroid meds, people think, oh, you shouldn't take thyroid meds first thing at night because it'll make it so you can't sleep. But that's not necessarily true, because it takes a while for the thyroid medicine to get on board. And the other thing about thyroid medication is you want to be taking it at least several hours, like about 3 hours away from consuming anything with calcium in it. So if you consume dairy, it's a good idea 3-4 hours away, so that it's not in the stomach the same time as the dairy, because it blocks the absorption.
Right. So try not to have it with your kefir.
No, right.
Right.
Don't have it with your kefir. And also, if you like to drink coffee and you put milk or cream, you know, from dairy in your coffee, or even if you have a dairy substitute that's calcium fortified, you don't want to have it at the same time, because it's not going to work as well. Also doesn't work very well if you take it at the same time as soy. So if you like soy milk, if you drink soy milk for some reason, not a good idea to take it at the same time as soy, because it will compete for absorption with that. Also, if you're taking supplements to help your blood pressure, it might be a good idea to take those at night. Magnesium is a nice thing to take at night anyway, because magnesium is calming. It helps you sleep. It helps you detoxify. And you do a lot of detoxification. So magnesium is a good thing to take at night regardless. You could take Coenzyme Q10. Coenzyme Q10 is another one of those things you think of, oh, well, maybe I should take it during the day because it's energizing. So you could see if that's true. I don't know that CoQ10 gives me an immediate boost, but CoQ10 is also something that can help lower your blood pressure, so you might want to take that at night. Hawthorn and hibiscus. So if you take a hawthorn, like I take hawthorn solid extract, and I would do well to take that at night. And if you're doing hawthorn, you could make hawthorn and hibiscus tea and have that at night. And that would be nice. And if you threw in hawthorn, hibiscus, and linden together, that would be a great combination. It would be a great tea. You can have it at bedtime, and it would be nice and calming, and it would help lower blood pressure and help strengthen your blood vessels. And beet juice, that would be another one to try to have at night, because beet juice increases your nitric oxide production and it helps lower your blood pressure. So that increase in blood pressure, I'm not sure what the mechanism is, but people often wake up into an MI. They wake up into a heart attack. That's a thing that happens. And a lot of heart attacks happen first thing in the morning. So if you can get that blood pressure down, that's less likely to happen. I don't know if it's because of the transition from sleeping to getting up. People get into that too fast, and that's why it happens. Whereas, during the day, you're up and down and up and down. You're gradually working through your day.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you get up in the morning, you're transitioning from sleeping to getting up and doing stuff. So I don't know.
So you should get up slower.
I know. Wouldn't that be great?
Greet your day with less haste.
Yeah. Greeting your day with less haste. That's a good thing. It's so hard to do if you're a busy person, if you have to be at work early, if you're exercising, if you have kids to get out the door. Greeting your day. You know, I envy people who ease into their days. I look forward to the day when I'm able to do that.
Mm.
That's just not a reality for me at this time. I mean, I would have to get up much earlier, which would mean I would have to go to sleep a lot earlier. for me to ease into my day. And because, you know, for me to be here, to be to get some exercise and get some stuff done and be here, you know, I have to get up in the 7 o'clock hour. And, you know, once I'm up, I mean, I suppose I could get up in the 6 o'clock hour, but I'm not ready to get up if I've, you know, if I came home last night in the 10 o'clock hour. And that's just my reality at this time. So hopefully that will change. But it's true. If you can ease into your day, that's a great thing to do. I just don't know a lot of people who have that luxury, you know, to get up early, sit and drink coffee, or read the paper. I mean, if you're retired, but, you know, that's not me.
Yeah. So. And in which case, I mean, and if you're not, I suppose the other answer is to get up earlier and allow yourself more downtime in the morning. But
right.
That's hard, too.
That's hard that's to really do hard if too. You're if your day ends late. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go to bed at 8 or 9 o'clock, sure.
Yeah.
But
I know people that do that.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, they don't run a business.
Not, they're not me.
Well, they're not. And
they're
you
not
know,
you. They're
no.
definitely not you.
Well, I'm at my business until ridiculous hours on those nights. So it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But anyway, that may be why you have more cardiovascular events first thing in the morning, because people are rushing into their days. That may be one reason why. But you may be able to mitigate that by taking your blood pressure medication at night. And also, if you're taking blood pressure supplements like magnesium, coenzyme Q10, hawthorn, hibiscus, passion flower, beet juice, all those things, you could take those at night too. All right. So here's an interesting one. Here's why you crave starchy, fatty foods when you're sleep deprived.
Mm.
So I didn't realize this, but sleep deprivation, if you don't get enough sleep, it suppresses leptin. Leptin is your satiety. It's your satiety hormone. It increases your feelings of feeling full, of feeling like you ate something and you don't need to eat anything else.
Okay.
And also sleep deprivation increases ghrelin, which is your hunger hormone. You will have more ghrelin around. When you have more ghrelin around, it makes you feel hungry. And they say leptin is light. Ghrelin is growl, like, you know, makes, because your stomach is growling when you have a lot of ghrelin around. You also stimulate endocannabinoids. So endocannabinoids, you know how when you smoke pot, you get the munchies?
Mm.
You don't know what that's like.
No.
Anyway, so when you stimulate endocannabinoids such as 2-AG, it makes you crave starchy, sugary, and fatty things.
Mm.
So so when you are sleep deprived, you stimulate this 2-AG. It's an endocannabinoid, which is one of the endocannabinoids that gets stimulated when you ingest THC. So so you get the munchies.
I get the munchies even when I'm not.
Well, you right now are getting lots of munchies because you lost a lot of weight.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
And you didn't have a lot of weight to lose.
No.
So now you're like, can we please have a hamburger? And I finally relented that last Saturday and said, all right, let's have a hamburger.
Yeah.
So we finally had our weekly burger.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it was great.
It was good. Yeah.
I had no problems with it.
Yeah. I'm going to see if I can go to Black Mountain Burger this weekend in Lincoln.
Okay.
See if I can get Rob to get me over there. So, all right. So, so the solution for that leptin suppression and ghrelin increase, it's really simple. Get more sleep.
Mm.
So sleep So one of the things that I try to tell people is sleep and rest are treatments for whatever you have going on. They are definitely part of weight loss. It's not just about getting more exercise and getting more exercise and eating less food or eating differently. It's also about resting. When you are sleeping, you don't need to eat. When you get more rest, you don't need to eat as much. And so if you wake up one morning and you're like, you know, I'm really not up for that workout, the best thing to do might be to sleep in. Because if you're sleeping actually helps you to lose fat because you're resting more, your cortisol is lower. Any kind of rest or restorative activity you get lowers cortisol. If you have too much cortisol around, cortisol puts sugar into your blood and which then raises your insulin, and insulin causes fat storage. So if you get sleep and rest, your cortisol will be lower. So if you're just going, you're going to be more likely to be hungry. And it's also a very primal instinct to want to eat when food is available. So if you're not sleeping, you're going to be looking for food to support whatever activity you're doing. So it's also at a very primal level. If you're awake, you're going to be like, all right, where's my food? And that comes from, that's like from the beginning of time. That's what you did. I mean, because food was scarce. So you had to spend a lot of your time looking for food. So you know how when you're not doing anything else, you start picking around and looking for what's good to eat.
Sure.
Yeah, right. So maybe if you're hungry and you're eating too much, one good thing to do might be to take a nap. So rest and sleep help with fat loss. I can't say it enough times.
Well, if you eat too much, you'll want to take a nap anyway.
Well, then you have that postprandial issue. Mm. That's when you eat too much. But if you eat too much, if you eat more food than you need, you're going to store it. So, yeah, that makes you sleepy too, but that's a different mechanism.
Mm.
But overeating doesn't help with fat loss.
No.
Unless you believe in the concept of the cheat day. Because one of the problems that you have when you reduce your intake is you lower your leptin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and also women, when we restrict our intake, our leptin goes down more than men's leptin when you guys decrease your intake. So we have a really distinct disadvantage. So this is a crazy thing. When you decrease your intake because you're on a diet, or you know, you're decreasing your intake, your leptin goes down, so you get hungrier. So it's not just, you're not just hungrier just because you're not eating as much. You're hungry because your body feels like you're somewhat starving.
Mm-hmm.
That's why. So then the hormones respond that way. It's a good time. So you have to find that sweet spot. That sweet spot of eating enough less food that you, because fat loss happens in an environment of caloric restriction, of caloric reduction and hormonal balance. So if you don't have both of those things, you're not going to lose fat. So if you're not in hormonal balance, you're not going to be in hormonal balance if you're sleep deprived and if you're rest deprived and if you're stressed. So all of those things are, they're not hormonal balance. So I just can't emphasize enough that reducing stress and getting adequate sleep, though, they're part of fat loss.
Mm.
They're really part of fat loss. And if you don't do those things, if you don't get enough sleep and you don't get enough rest, you're going to have more trouble because that high cortisol makes you hungry. That's the way it is. So figuring that out is a really good idea. And so one of the interesting things is I find that people really have to figure out what's going to work for them in terms of, because of that leptin suppression, people have to figure out what's really going to work for them to make them feel satisfied while they're altering their diet so they can experience fat loss. And the answer is that it's different for everybody. You know, the amount of carbs that people need to eat in order to experience fat loss differs for different people. And, you know, there's the ketogenic diets are very popular right now. And I think the ketogenic diets are not for everybody, that they are for a significant percentage of the population, but they're definitely not for everybody. You know, my friend Carl was correct when he said that there are no essential carbohydrates. And any scientist who knows nutrition will tell you that there are no essential carbohydrates. There are essential, protein is essential for you to eat and fat is essential for you to eat. So there's essential amino acids. There are 9 of them. And there are essential fatty acids, but there are no essential carbohydrates. You do not actually have to eat any carbohydrates at all.
Hmm.
Yeah. So why is that? Because they're not essential, because your body produces them. So your body can take protein and turn it into carbohydrate if it needs to. And your body can also take fat and burn it for energy.
Hmm.
So you don't necessarily need to eat carbohydrates. Having said that, a lot of people, I would say that most people, if they don't eat anything that has some carbohydrate in it, they don't feel well. That the percentage of people that does well on the ketogenic diet is probably less than half.
Yeah.
It's, and you know, because the people who do well on it often have the ApoE gene. They have the ApoE4 gene, the one that's the most concerning in terms of cardiovascular health. And that's a small percentage of the population. So, but there's a significant percent of the population that does well in the ketogenic diet. If you do the ketogenic diet and you just can't stay with it, it might not be for you. The reason might be it's because it's not for you. And I think that's probably true of most people, that most people, in my observation, they certainly like to eat some carbs, but they may even need to. And by carbs, I just mean that they need to eat some plant matter. They need to eat some fruit. That the problem is they're just eating a lot of processed high-calorie food, and that's why they're gaining weight and probably not getting enough physical activity. That when I see what people eat, it's usually not so much that they're not eating a ketogenic diet. It's that they're eating that their diet is overwhelmingly starchy.
Mm.
That they're eating cereal for breakfasts, sandwiches for lunch, and pasta for dinner, and not a lot of produce.
The all-American diet.
Yeah, it's just generally what I see. So, yeah. So that's a bunch of interesting stuff. All right. So you're probably we got into fat loss a little bit. So let's see, why do you think cruciferous vegetables are good for you?
I don't know.
Oh, do you know what a cruciferous vegetable is?
Nope.
You don't?
No. You're going to tell me, though.
Yeah.
Because that's what we do. We talk about things.
Yes. Okay, so let's talk about cruciferous vegetables for a couple of minutes. So cruciferous vegetables have a good and questionable reputation. Mostly they're really, really good for you. First of all, they're vegetables. Second of all, they're non-starchy vegetables. And what a cruciferous vegetable is, it's in the mustard family. So they're otherwise known as the brassicaceae, the brassicas. And that's the cruciferous vegetable family. And so I think they're called cruciferous because the way they grow, they have little crusses inside them. That's how they flower and stuff. Their flowers cross over each other.
Be where cruciferous comes from.
Yes,
I gotcha.
Exactly.
I gotcha.
So they have a lot of health benefits. So there's a lot. They're all really high. They tend to be low in calories. They have a lot of vitamins, minerals, and a lot of antioxidants. And they have a lot of really neat, interesting health compounds. So they're brassicaceae. Like I said, they're cross-bearing, and their flowers tend to look like little cresses. You can get them in Europe, the Mediterranean, and the temperate regions of Asia, but they're grown everywhere, and they tend to be high in it says they're high in vitamin A. I don't know why they say that, because my understanding is there isn't vitamin A in vegetables. There's only beta carotene carotenoids in vegetables, which means that there's beta carotene in them, which you can then convert to vitamin A. There's also vitamin C. So there's vitamin C in your broccoli. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Vitamin C in your broccoli.
Yeah, I did know that.
And they all have vitamin K, mostly K1.
And in pine needles, too.
Vitamin C in pine needles. That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah. Very strange places that there would be vitamin C.
Well, it's strange to us because, you know, we were just always taught vitamin C equals citrus.
Right.
Which is ridiculous because that doesn't grow here. And yet, you know, people survived here for centuries without touching oranges. You don't have to eat oranges to get vitamin C. You know, the vitamin C is in, it's in peppers and it's in cruciferous vegetables. So they're unique because they have sulfur-bearing compounds called glucosinolates, and they're cancer-fighting. They've been listed to a long, they have a long list of health benefits, improved heart health, fat loss, reduced inflammation. And so here's a whole bunch of cruciferous vegetables: arugula, bok choy, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, collard greens, kale, kohlrabi, maca is that stuff that grows in the Andes. You know, maca. I thought maca was a Solanaceae, but I'll look that up. Mizuna, which is a very spicy green, other kinds of mustard greens, all your radishes, your rutabaga, your turnips, and your watercress. They're all brassicaceae. Did we say arugula? Yeah, arugula is number one. Arugula is my favorite.
You like arugula.
I love arugula.
You like arugula.
It's my friend.
Yeah, you
yes.
do.
Yes.
It's spicy.
So they have a lot of cancer-fighting compounds, and they are anti-inflammatory. They help to reduce your blood sugar. They promote weight loss. They enhance your heart health, and they promote estrogen balance. So, so they have a whole bunch of cancer-fighting compounds. They have wonderful antioxidants. The glucosinolates are the ones like indole-3-carbinol that help to ward off cancer. We do eat a lot of arugula because I make us eat a lot of, but we could eat more. We could stand to eat more broccoli. I think we.
We could. We do eat a lot of arugula because if it's not just, you know, that we buy arugula separately, it's also in the spicy mix.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right. And it's terrific.
Shout out to Brian and Anita for the spicy mix from Tobacco Road Farm.
Yeah, so super, yes, and very, very nutritious. We have ultra-nutritious greens that we eat.
We do.
So there's a positive association between consumption of cruciferous vegetables and cancer prevention. So there was a review where there were 94 studies, and that showed that a higher intake of cruciferous vegetables was linked to a lower risk of lung, stomach, colon, and rectal cancer. So there's other cancer-fighting foods, too. Berries, citrus, fruits, nuts, and seeds, which are not cruciferous vegetables, but they're also cancer-fighting.
These are things that you don't get from pizza and French fries, by the way.
Yeah, right. Well, to be fair, if you eat pizza and there...
You could make a healthy pizza.
You could put cruciferous vegetables on the pizza. You could put broccoli on your pizza.
Yeah,
yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pizza, if you get a red pizza and it has tomato sauce on it, that tomato sauce has been baked. So when you take tomatoes and you cook them down, you make the lycopene in them more bioavailable. And lycopene is a wonderful anti-cancer compound. So really one of the best ways. Now, mind you, again, we've gone off track a little bit, but that's fine.
That's all right.
Lycopene is a, lycopene is a carotenoid. And it's good for prostate health, and it's good for fighting cancer. And the best way to get it is actually tomato juice,
or good sauce, your
sauce. But yeah. The sauce has to be heated at really high temperatures. The reason that tomato juice is the best way to get the lycopene is because it's been pasteurized.
Yeah.
A high temperature. Yeah. Whereas you don't do that to tomato sauce, mind you. You will get more lycopene bioavailable from tomato sauce than you will from a fresh tomato. So on the other hand, when you eat a fresh tomato, there are enzymes you're going to get, that there are nutrients you're going to get from a fresh tomato that are harder to get when the tomato is cooked. But the big thing about carotenoids, any food that you eat with carotenoids in it, so your kale, your collard greens, any green, if it's cooked. So the thing is, cooked arugula is no fun to eat because it's just such a light green. Yeah. But collard greens, you almost have to cook it. You have to cook it or at least distress it. They're so good for you. He's making a face, and they're so good for you.
I made a face.
And it's unfortunate because we really should be eating some kale and some collard greens because they're good for us.
I know they are.
And we should just find a way to cook them that you like.
That,
because
you know,
they're really amazingly good for you. And
we should be eating Brussels sprouts, too.
Well, we can't. Those, you know, I draw the line because I have a taste aversion there.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to figure out a way to, yeah, but.
I know. I mean, but I finding a way to cook them is the trick.
I think collards and kale, though, I mean, they're not as obnoxious in terms of the sulfur compounds as the Brussels sprouts. And
yeah, they're obnoxious in other ways.
Okay. All right, anyway. But I think it would be good to find a way to cook them so that we could eat them more. So I think what I'm going to do is leave you hanging a little bit. So there's a cliffhanger. There's more good reasons to consume your cruciferous vegetables, which I will get to either next week or the week after, because this weekend I'm going to the New Hampshire Association of Naturopathic Doctors Conference.
You're
going to
come back all smart and stuff.
I know. So yeah. I'll probably have some
interesting... Not that you're not smart already.
Thank you. I'll probably come back with a bunch of lovely things to talk about that I learned at the conference, because I always learn something new there, and I always enjoy that conference. So big shout out to the New Hampshire Association of Naturopathic Doctors for putting on a fun time. We're going to the Double Tree in Nashua. Beautiful downtown Nashua.
Beautiful downtown Nashua.
Yeah, Nashua. I mean, Nashua has pretty spots in it, but Nashua is one. It's just over the Mass border. It's got a lot of shopping in it because I think New Hampshire doesn't have sales tax. And it's where the highways come together. So there's a lot of shopping and there's a lot of hotels. So we always went to the Courtyard by Marriott, but this year we're going to the DoubleTree. What can I say? All right. So anyway, I'm going to go. It was nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you, too.
Thank you. And happy Mischief Night. Happy Halloween. Stay safe. Eat some candy. Don't eat all the candy. Have fun with chocolate. And we'll see you next week with more Radio Naturopath. So let me see. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I'm Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores.